Hello, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Siobhan Barco, the host of New Books in Law. Today we will be discussing Maryland Equine Law, A Legal Guide to Horse Ownership and Activities, by Kathleen J.P. Tabor and Jan I. Berlage. Tabor is a Maryland-based attorney who specializes in agricultural law, equine law, business and contract law, family law, and mediation services. Attorney Tabor, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much. My pleasure.
Could you begin the interview by saying a few words about yourself, your background, and how you became attracted to practicing equine law?
Well, certainly. Actually, I got involved with horses at a very young age. About 5 years old, my grandfather put me up on a pony that his brother had a hack stable at and snapped the end of the horse and off I went. So I learned how to ride, I learned how to fall. And I've had horses involved in my life ever since. I've owned a few and ridden them. I held a pari-mutuel teller's license after I moved here to Maryland. I grew up in Michigan. And that I did that just before I entered into law school. I drove commercial carriage in Philadelphia and Baltimore. And so I've kind of dabbled around with horses in all kinds of ways. But I'm primarily, I consider myself a pleasure rider. I got involved with equine law when I decided at a late stage in my life to go back to law school. And I walked into one of the schools that I was checking out applying for, and I saw this little flyer on a kiosk that said, Brown Bag Lunch, Equine Law. And it just kind of stopped me in my tracks because I was actually at that point in my life thinking of focusing on education law. And because I had dedicated my life to kids and education up until that point in my life, I thought, let's do horses. And so I started exploring equine law. And the way I did that is I actually contacted the National Thoroughbred Racing Association in Kentucky. I was, even though I don't own a thoroughbred, I enjoy the sport, had joined as a charter member of that organization years before. And so I called and I said, what's the chances that there's somebody on your board of directors who's an attorney that lives in Maryland that graduated from the University of Baltimore School of Law? And there happened to be someone. So I got in touch with him and asked him if he would be my mentor during law school. And so that's how I got involved with equine law. I asked, what is this thing called equine law? Because there was no such field identified by the ABA or any other bar association. And he said it's everything. The clientele are those individuals involved in horses in one capacity or another. And whatever their legal needs are, that's what you do. And because of that, your day is never the same from day to day. And that really appealed to me. So that's why I got focused on equine law.
Okay. So could you tell me now how you came to write your book?
Sure. After graduating from law school, I was sitting on a committee for mentoring young students into law, so high schoolers, mostly inner city youth. And one of the other board members, we're sitting there chit-chatting at dinner time, and there was a judge who used to tease me about being the horse attorney. He just thought it was hilarious. And he always liked to make jokes about, did I get paid in hay? And, what kind of issues did a horse have that needed an attorney and that kind of stuff. So he was laughing me when this other gentleman, Jan Berlage, said, you do horse law? And I said, sure. And so he goes, let's talk. And so we started talking and got to know each other. And he himself plays polo, among other sports, but he's mostly a bankruptcy and, large business type of an attorney. So he was fascinated that there was this little solo practitioner focusing on equine law. And as we were talking over, a course of about a year and a half, he kept encouraging me to write a book because I had developed some forms and documents that were very state-specific, because Maryland can be a little quirky when it comes to law. And so after agreeing to help me out with the book, we sat down, wrote the book. We had a contract to have it published through a company that actually 2 months before we were finished went bankrupt. So we ended up self-publishing. But that's not been so bad. It's been kind of fun promoting the book. And so that's how the book came about.
Could you describe the ways equine activities fit into Maryland's culture and economy?
Sure. Maryland is very rich in horse history. The Maryland Jockey Club is the oldest jockey club in the nation. It's, you know, obviously, you know, the Preakness is ran here at Pimlico. But per square mile, for the size of the state, Maryland has more horses per capita than any other state, including Kentucky or New York or California, any of the other states. It's very diverse in that there are, trying to recall how many different breeds and activities there are here in Maryland. It's stupendous. We've been doing census of equine census through the Maryland Horse Industry Board, which is part of the Maryland Department of Agriculture. I also sit on that board. And our latest census in 2010 showed that we had 79,100 horses, ponies, mules, donkeys, and burros in our state, which was slightly down from our 2002 census. But basically, light horse breeds account for 50% of the total inventory of horses here. Racehorse breeds are about 37% of the total. And the value of the equine inventory is over $714 million. So it's an industry when you take all of that plus all the support industries, which is who I represent. So that would be everything like, you know, farriers and tack shops and grains and all that. When you add in all of that, we have a $5.6 billion commodity here in the state of Maryland. So agriculture is the number one commodity in Maryland, and horses rank number three within that industry. It's pretty huge. It's ingrained in the state. You know, we have fox hunting. We have rodeos. We have cutting horses, reining horses, dressage, hunter jumpers, carriage horses, pony rides, racehorsing, standardbreds and thoroughbreds. We're looking to bring in Arabian horse racing to the state. That's a current bill in our General Assembly. So there's a lot going on here in the state of Maryland when it comes to horses.
I went to the Preakness a while ago now and also rode in a beautiful state park near Towson, Maryland, I think.
Mm-hmm. Gunpowder?
Maybe. It was
or Patapsco.
I'm not sure. It was nice. They had some cross-country jumps and trails.
Oh, you went up to Fairhill.
Maybe. It was
yeah.
Nice. Okay, so you mentioned that you
Well, that's another thing I should mention. I hate to interrupt you, but
no problem.
Should also bring up. We're looking, you know, the state, the MHIB, the Maryland Horse Industry Board, has been looking to create a horse park, but not like in Kentucky or New Jersey or some other places where they have horse parks. Because of the state of Maryland and because of our inventory and the depth of activity, we're kind of connecting what we have already to create a horse park. And so we have the Prince George's Equestrian Center, which is a large indoor arena where we have like the Capital Challenge and several other large activities are held down there. We have Fair Hill, where we have the cross country and the trails, and we have a training center up there. We have Maryland is one of the few states, really few, that actually license their commercial stables. So if you board, train, give lessons, or a rescue or a sanctuary, It's our responsibility as a state to make sure that the horses are well cared for and the facility is clean and safe. And so we license annually these facilities. And of the, we have over 700 stables licensed. We have about 35 of them went through another program where we called a certification for horse discovery centers. And these are facilities that were willing to open up their doors at no charge to the general public just to come onto the property and learn some aspect of the horse industry. So maybe about breeds or shoeing or riding or just, you know, how to groom a horse, the different types of tack, carriage riding, that kind of thing. And that's all throughout the state of Maryland, Eastern Shore and the mainland. And so what we're doing with the horse park concept is connecting our horse discovery centers, our trails, our parks, our Prince George's Equestrian Center, Fair Hills, and we're just kind of connecting these all together to create a tourism mecca for people who really enjoy horses and want to come and enjoy them in one way or another.
Great.
So, anyway.
Well, I was already a horse tourist.
I'm very proud of that.
So the potential's definitely there. What are some common legal issues that arise around equine activities?
Well, a lot of what I do is help people be successful in operating their equine activities, either boarding facility lessons, training, racing syndication, just or sales, leases. So what I try to do when I help people put their business structures together and their contracts and such, is advise them on best business practices and the liabilities involved, some of the legal problems that they might run into, and how to avoid these by good business practices so that they don't wind up in court. I was a trained mediator while I was still in law school, and so I really come from that angle when I'm helping people put their business plans together and such, that it's better to try to find ways of resolving your dispute when they do arise, other than just running off to court. Because, you know, the horse world is so small, and eventually they're going to come across that person again, either in the Florida circuit or, you know, some show or just at the state fair, you know, they're going to run across them. So there's a lot of, you know, contract issues. There's the safety issue, liability, making sure the property's safe, the horses are, you match the right rider with the right type of horse. A lot of disputes will be over payment of services. There's a lot of folks who, you know, get involved in horses because they're such nice-looking animals, and they're fun to be around, and it's an awesome activity. But when it comes time to making those bill payments, sometimes, you know, the boarding stable or the lesson stable is the bottom of the list. So then we run into issues of collecting fees. The nice thing here in Maryland when it comes to boarding stables is we have livestock lien, where without needing to go to court, there's a procedure whereby you notify the person when they're 30 days in arrears that in the next 30 days, if payment's not made, that they will place the horse up for public auction. And that auction can take place on that person's property or at an auction house. And they have to come up with the payment. And if they don't, the horse is auctioned for that payment. If the horse brings in money that's more than what was owed, that excess money goes back to the owner, and of course the horse is sold to the next whoever bought it. If the money brought in doesn't cover those expenses, then of course then the one who's owed the money can go to small claims court and collect that judgment. So that's a tool that I've had to use quite often, actually.
Okay.
And then, you know, just injuries in general, you know, that making sure that you know, tack is in good condition, that gates are closed, they're, you know, ground, you know, as much as you can, the surface of the ground is conducive to doing the activities that you're doing. So there's a wide range of that in general, but then you also can run into estate, you know, succession planning, what do you do with the horses when someone passes away? It's amazing. It's just, it never ceases to amaze me. I just had someone call me about abandoned semen. And who can claim it? So I never know when I pick up the phone exactly what's going to be asked of me.
All right. Could you go through the different sources of equine law?
Well, it's the same as with any law, actually. You know, you have your federal, state, local, and your municipalities, and then you look to your statutes, your regulations, your common law. It's really, again, it's going to depend on what particular issue is arising that where you're going to go look. I know many states have the equine liability statute. Maryland does not. We don't need a statute of that nature because we have the contributory negligence standard, and our courts recognize assumption of risk, last clear chance, and the validity of contracts or a waiver. So our horse activities are pretty much covered under those things. The issue that I have with equine liability statutes is that the language varies from state to state. Some of them are very specific as to font size, where the signage has to be posted. If it's not, you know, you invalidate the protection. And I just feel like, in general, it gives a false sense of security to the provider as well as to the person accessing themselves to those services. You know, they think that, oh, this will take care of me if something bad happens. When, if you look at the case law that's developed over the years now since these become popular, there are so many exceptions that it really doesn't provide that protection, I think, that it was intended to give. So I'm thankful Maryland does not have an equine liability statute, and I kind of preach against it whenever somebody brings it up that we should get it here. But did I go off topic?
No. No, that's perfect. What are some issues that you have seen arise with title and ownership in a free lease situation, for example?
Oh, yeah. I love that. It's, you know, it was amazing. I grew up and lived in Michigan for most of my life until I moved here in my 40s. And then I came across one of my first questions that kind of stopped me in my tracks was, someone called and they said, I free-leased my horse with so-and-so and they won't give it back to me now. And I had never in my life heard of a free lease. So I was quickly contacting some of my clients who had been in the horse business here at Maryland for a long time. And they said, oh, yeah, people do that all the time. The interesting thing was that often a free lease was also done orally. It was not put into writing. So the first issue that I found was that it's not in writing. And so it's a he said, she said situation. And basically, you know, a judge or a trier of fact is going to look at the fact that you took your horse that you could not take care of for whatever reason. You moved away, your job didn't allow you, you couldn't afford it, you know, whatever. And you gave it to a trusted friend who's been feeding it and providing health care for it and riding it and loving it for the last 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, and now you want it back at no cost. And so I started putting free leases into writing for people to, you know, just make it very clear that they were not turning over their right of ownership or title of this horse, and that the exchange was that, and, you know, for you to have this horse and take care of it and everything, I'm letting you use it at, for whatever purpose you want until such time that I come to call for it again. And, you know, people agree to it, that's fine. If they don't do it. But basically, the biggest issue that with pre-leases was just not having it in writing and trying to prove that you actually own this horse, because, you know, horses aren't titled like cars. A registration with a breed association really doesn't mean a whole lot to the courts either. It just shows that you registered their horse, or if you have a USDF registration, you're using that horse for competition. It might say owner, but, you know, pretty much that doesn't, right? That's not a whole lot of support. The bill of sale helps a lot, which people get confused when they're buying and selling horses to get a bill of sale that's sufficient. To me, I try to explain that a bill of sale is actually the receipt. It's the purchase and sales agreement sets out the terms of how you're going to purchase this horse, and, you know, hopefully you're going to pre-purchase that it, and you're going to, you know, maybe have it on a trial basis, or, you know, how the payment is made. And then when the payment is made, here's your bill of sale. You paid for this horse, and it's now yours, as is and without fault. And the few times that I've actually had to go to court on the issue of ownership, that has gone a long way. That bill of sale and the purchase and sale agreement showing that there was this transaction that occurred. For the most part, when my clients have had maybe issues with the leasing or sale of a horse, another attorney will call me, we talk about it, and it's pretty much resolved before it ever gets to court. So there's been a few times where I've had to negotiate the physical exchange of a horse to another person. And a couple times, you know, we've had to have the police come and stand there while it's done. But it's usually an amicable situation. It's been interesting.
Sounds like it. I hear a lot about horses abandoned, which is the opposite issue, bill collection.
Yeah, that's a very sad situation. And, you know, that we can go into all kinds of reasons why that's happened. But, yeah, the hoarding, or people just, you know, taking on horses and not being able to afford to take care of them, not knowing what to do with them anymore, afraid to send them to New Holland or Thurmont or some other auction house because you're afraid a meat buyer's going to take them. Or, so, you know, there's different legislation right now, you know, the SAFE Act, you know, preventing horses to be transported for slaughter purposes for human consumption in Congress. And here in Maryland, we have a group called the Maryland Fund for Horses, who is working on the issue of what to do with people's horses that they can no longer care for, and trying to create a center where they can bring their horses and leave them, you know, turn ownership over to this association to repurpose or, you know, care for the horse. So, and that's fun. I work with that group and help them with their legal documents as well. So,
yeah.
And I work with some rescue organizations, and it's really interesting, the breadth of clientele that I'm privileged to work with.
All right. There's several different topics you discuss in your book that fall under the umbrella of tort law and negligence. Could you talk about how tort law and horses intersect?
Well, it's, you know, basically you're thinking of personal injury or property damage. And when you think of horses, which is such a high-risk animal anyway, it's like, you might as well write tort on the side of the horse. I love it when people say they have a bomb-proof horse, but there will come a time when even a bomb-proof horse is going to act like a horse. You know, they're going to flee if they think there's something's going to get them. And when they do, you know, they're not a reasoning sort of animal, and they're going to run. So they run through fences. They run out in front of cars. They run over people. They'll throw people off their backs if they're, you know, I think that's when waivers really are important. And I know I've heard attorneys say, oh, you know, waiver's not worth the paper it's written on. But I think a well-written waiver, a very well-informed participant, and if you put in as many safeguards as you can, like requiring the use of helmets, safety vests if you're going to be doing jumping, proper footwear. You put these criteria in place before you let somebody get up on a horse. And you hope for the best. Make sure you match the horse and the rider as well as you can. You know, disclosure of a horse's traits are important. Disclosure of a person's riding level, experience is important. Honesty goes a long way in keeping you safe in this industry. And with the waivers, it's important to remember, too, you know, you need to be an adult to sign away any of your rights. So when you're dealing with children, that's a whole nother, you know, box of ills that you're going to run into with kids and horses, and of course that's a bulk of a lot of people's business is dealing with children. So educating them and making sure that, you know, they're able to follow the instructions and direction, and that you teach them the right seat and all that, it'll help go a long way in keeping people safe. But I'm a big proponent of using waivers and of informing people of the assumption of risks that they're taking, which, of course, can include death, injury, or damage to property. And I do my best to try to protect my clients against such claims and whatever I can do to make it a good environment for everybody.
Right. Some of the other negligence areas you talked about were malpractice and premises liability.
Right. Yeah. With the premise liability, you need to make sure that your facility is safe, you know, that your fencing is safe, that and it's the proper type of fencing and gates, the environment in which the horses live are safe. That when people come onto your property, you know, they're not going to fall into holes. You need to be aware of the nature of your property. You know, you send people out on a trail ride, make sure you know that, you know, your trail's clear and safe for people to venture out on. You know, for the most part, when you're involved with horses, you're not anywhere near a hospital or a doctor or anything, and if something bad happens, you're probably going to be airlifted out. So that's why it's important to talk to people about their assumption of risk, and you know that if something bad happens, this is what could happen, and you're going to be responsible for the cost. I'm not. And again, here in Maryland, with contributory negligence, if you know, all things being perfect, if they've contributed to their own bad, you know, if they took the horse on a part of the trail they weren't supposed to, or if they insisted on riding a horse that is beyond their capability of riding, you know, they contributed to their bad, and they're not going to collect anything. So, and I tell people all the time, you know, when it comes to insuring your activities, you're either self-insured or you get insurance through a company. And you need to be sure that when you purchase insurance, you disclose all the type of activities that you're doing. And yes, it's expensive, but in the event that you know, somebody can collect, you don't want it coming out of your bank account. You don't want to lose your business.
How does the mobile nature of horse sports crossing county, state, or even international boundaries complicate liability issues?
Oh, absolutely. And that's when you really, you know, if you're, especially competitors, when you're going, you know, dealing like with the USEF, you need to know what states have the equine liability statutes. You need to understand what those statutes mean. You'll have the issues of, well, it's kind of going beyond the liability, but, you know, drug testing. You know, what in certain competitions, what supplements you can give your horses and you can't give your horses. A trainer can be suspended or lose their license, be heavily fined if in sports competitions, racing or otherwise. So, it's something you need to be aware of. Quarantine laws when you're dealing with international, bringing horses in, you know, you want to buy that pretty German warm blood, bring it over here for hunter jumper purposes, whatever. And you need to understand, you know, all those requirements and regulations you have to go through to get your that animal over here. It's interesting when I have dealt with, I actually dealt once with a saddle manufacturing company that were having their saddles made in Germany and helped them with their legal documents on that. This is a fun field to be in, I'm telling you. It's never a dull moment.
Sounds like you do everything.
It's fun, that's for sure. But, you know, I've been very fortunate in that I honestly, in the, what's it been now, 12 years that I've been practicing, you know, I probably can count on both hands how many times I've actually had to deal with a court issue. Because I work real diligently with my clients on their paperwork, on their documents, their contracts, educating them on risks and, you know, again, business practices so that, you know, they're not spending their time in court or worrying about going to court. They're spending their time with the horses and making money in their business the best that they can anyway.
Okay, well, that leads us nicely to my next question. When does a horse hobby become a business, or when does something you think is a business, maybe it's really a hobby, and what are some of the ways that you work with horse businesses?
Well, the interesting thing, again, not that I'm trying to promote the Equine Law Conference in Kentucky, but it's an awesome conference. If anyone is remotely interested in this field, they should attend at least once. And one year, we had the privilege of having an IRS agent come speak to us how they evaluate returns that have anything to do with horses on it, whether it's a horse business or if they determined it's a hobby and such. And of course, the American Horse Council has their publications. I think it's a tax publication where they talk about the various cases that are brought because someone said they had a business when in fact it was a hobby or vice versa. But the interesting thing what this agent told us was that there wasn't, of course, there's no one criteria that red flags a return. But if they see anything with horses and deductions, they're going to look at it a little more carefully. And particularly if they're claiming it to be a business. And they're going to look at things like, do you have income coming elsewhere? And then they're going to want to determine how much time do you dedicate to this particular activity? Is it the type of time you dedicate to a hobby, or is it the type of time that you would dedicate to a business where you're trying to make money? I always tell folks that, pre-planning is your business, your horse, your equine activities into a business is important. And consulting with attorneys, consulting with people in that field, obtaining self-education through conferences, seminars, trade magazines, your local extension services, your Department of Ag, anything you do that that demonstrates to the IRS that you're dedicating yourself to learning on how to make this business successful goes a long way to demonstrating that it's not a hobby. There's no one criteria, but good bookkeeping is really, really important. Having your business formalized, so like it's a limited liability company, or it's a corporation, or it's a nonprofit. Filing your returns, having your operating agreement or your bylaws, in place. A business plan, huge. Paying any sales and use tax that might be applicable to your activity. Having contracts, addressing employment issues. Do you have employees? Do you hire independent contractors? Do you, that kind of thing. So there's a lot of different aspects to what you're doing that the IRS is going to analyze to determine if it's a bona fide business or if it's a hobby. So I try to help my client build what I call a business team. And so that's, having an attorney, having a financial specialist or banker, a CPA or an accountant, knowing your insurance agent, and then again, other specific agencies or organizations that relate to your business. And by having these resources and using these resources really shows that even if you're not making that money that you'd like to be making, you're striving to achieve that goal, and you're using everything at your availability to do that. So that's pretty much the best way I can describe the differences between a business and a hobby.
Okay.
There's times I've questioned people if what they're really doing is for profit. And again, nonprofits are allowed to make a profit. So, I spend a lot of time when I consult with somebody. I spend a lot of time talking to them about what they're doing, what they want to do, what their goals and aspirations are, to just try to guide them the best that I can. And then offer them my services, drafting contracts and putting them on the right path the best I can.
Do you think it's helpful for people seeking an attorney to find one who knows the horse industry?
Yes, I do. And that's one reason why I wrote the book. We wanted to write it so that either a lay person or an attorney who was not familiar with the horse industry could pick it up and learn something. So the lay person who doesn't know a lot about the law could learn enough to be able to have a good conversation with an attorney. And an attorney who didn't know much about horses could pick it up and learn something about the horse industry. And I've come across contracts, I've come across business documents, documents that were drafted by a very competent attorney but had no clue about how the horse industry operates. And it's a mess. And then the person says, this isn't working for me, and what do I do? And then, of course, there's amendments or changes, or I throw the whole thing out, start over. It's vital, I think, when you focus on a particular industry, or if you're going to assist somebody in a particular industry, that you're familiar with it or familiar with it enough to know who to call to get your level of competency up. And that's a requirement, you know, of all attorneys, is you need to be able to provide competent representation of your client. It would be the same thing if I'm not a tax attorney, and I don't pretend to be a tax attorney, which is one reason why Jan wrote the section on tax law in the book. But if somebody comes to me with a tax question, I send them to a tax attorney. I either have them call Jan or somebody else or call their CPA, but, you know, I don't make any pretense that I can give them good advice on that. The best advice I give them is to talk to somebody who knows. And that's what I would hope someone else would say to them if they came and said, I need a contract for my boarding, you know, business. And they would say, you need to talk to an attorney who knows the horse business. And so that's, I think that's vital. I think that we do a disservice to clients when we take on work that we think we can, you know, slide on. But it's important to feel confident and at least get your questions answered by someone who does know the industry.
How do you think lawyers help maintain a mutually beneficial relationship between and among equestrians?
My personal opinion is that you help them make decisions about disputes and hard situations before those disputes and hard situations arise. So, for instance, I have a mediation clause in all of my contracts that my clients have with their customers. And so there's, except for the livestock lien, that's the only exception. If there's a dispute that prior to just running off the court and filing fees and all that, that they try to sit down and resolve it either between themselves or with a mediator. And the other is in boarding agreements. This is with my discussions with veterinarians in the area. I have in my client's boarding agreements places in there for the boarder to make a decision as to what happens if my horse becomes seriously ill or dies. You know, what do we do with it? It happens. I mean, even a young, healthy horse can impale itself on a, you know, fence and kill itself. Horses do crazy things. So do you, you know, for the most part, you're not going to bury it on the property. So, you know, how are you disposing of it? Are you going to call the rendering company? Are you going to call a company that does cremations? You're just going to haul it away yourself? You know, what's going to happen? What do you do if it colics? Is it eligible for surgery? What if I can't get in touch with you? You know, what do we do? So I have a lot of this stuff incorporated in my client's documents so that they can have these conversations before that situation arises. And I think that's a benefit all attorneys can do for their clients so that they have as much of a harmonious relationship with one another as possible. Because, again, the horse world is a small world, and you might think that the border is going to go away, but with social media and just the nature of the activity of horses, you're going to run into that person again, or somebody you know is going to run into them, and you don't need them, you know, spreading half-truths and, you know, not to the level of defamation. I've actually had to deal with that too, which has been interesting. But so I try my very best. I think an all attorney should try their very best to help the equestrian community get along as well as they can.
Well, I really want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you so much. I did too. This was fun.